Yeah. Welcome to Revelations with Julian Palmer. And that was the sound of me beating my chest. Today, I have a discussion with the Tibetan Chinese Australian comedian Nick Sun that occurred in September 2020. And what you're hearing is the sound of two guys who are living in the state of relative normality in a world that's going a bit choppo, while the outside temperature in Darwin is 35 degrees. So I think we had a fairly interesting discussion. Nick had a lot of questions he wanted to ask me. So a lot of this discussion was Nick interviewing me. And I think it was funny and insightful. And I hope you enjoy.
Okay, and welcome everyone to the Julian Palmer podcast.
That was an amazing voice. That should be your... I saw your future as a talk show host.
Well, welcome to the future.
Welcome to the future. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm here with Nick Sun. We're in Darwin, where it's really hot almost all the year. It's like Scandinavia, except it's not really cold, but it's really hot pretty much 9 months of the year. It's the 1st of September, which is Wattle Day in Australia. And so it's technically just turned spring and it's 35 degrees here. And between midday and 3 p.m. you cannot do jack. So now it's 6:26 p.m. And Nick has come over and we have three different recording devices because we want to make sure that all of them are working because they're all basically untested.
Yeah, and this is going to be a historical conversation. A meeting of amazing minds.
Two minds, maybe more. Two schizophrenic people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who haven't been sent to the gulags yet.
Not yet, but I'm expecting it. Well... I don't know, maybe we could start on that.
That's not how I want to create my reality.
That's Nick, fair enough.
I really don't want to create my reality that way.
Yep, yep.
I would prefer to maintain my freedom and sovereignty in the post-apocalyptic paradigm.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. So I definitely don't want to visualize the...
The
slave camps for dissident neo-shamans. I don't think that's the reality I'm looking to
That's fair manifest. Enough. I think a part of me is drawn to that. I don't know why.
Right.
I've been analysing my biases, you know? And there's a part of me that's, I don't know, it's drawn to dystopias. I don't know why.
Well, that's not a good sign, you know.
Well, at least I'm aware of my biases.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Perhaps if you are alive in 2020, then you're a dystopia lover too.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, talking to the general populace, maybe you like seeing global civilization crash and burn as well.
I don't know if I like. I like the idea of the current sort of system sort of going down as a chance for something better to come through. Definitely. Sometimes I wonder if it's because I'm just not very good at playing the current civilization game. So that's why I want it to end. So maybe I'll have a chance.
But you supported Doug Stanhope in, you know, you were sort of someone in the world in your previous incarnation as a comedy guy.
I was kind of somewhere, but no, I beg to differ. No. That was pretty much the peak.
People would pay money to see you say stuff on stage. You were sort of someone.
But not much money. Not enough money.
But you were living your dream and making money doing what you love, presumably. At least you weren't doing something that you hated doing.
That's true.
Which a lot of people are doing now. You had a little bit of a name for yourself. You have a certain amount of fandom, you know?
Yeah.
And you have a certain amount of fandom now. So I think, yeah, that's something to take into account.
Yeah. I don't know.
At least 100 true fans.
Yeah, about 100 true fans. But it's just never enough, Jules, you know?
You're greedy. You want 1,000 true fans.
No. It was more the security, you know? But even as flawed as that idea is, you know, the security and external circumstances, it's still a very fugitive existence.
Yeah. But you're living in a shipping container. You've got the shipping container locked down. You've got security.
Oh, I've got security now, yeah. I feel like less anxious than when I was a comedian, that's for sure.
Mm.
Because, the comedian's existence is very, very circumstantial. Some people debate whether or not it exists up until you get on stage for whatever, half an hour or not.
That life exists before you get on stage.
For a lot of comedians, yeah.
Right. And then life only happens in that moment.
Yeah, and then the rest is sort of this anxious build-up to this stage release, and then you're back to being existential terror.
Neurotic, suboptimal.
Yeah.
Human.
Yeah.
Subhuman.
Yeah. Pretty much. Not necessarily, but that's quite often the case from what I saw.
Yeah.
And I guess that was towards the end of my stint. That was where I was at, yeah.
Mm. But you feel like you're on your path now. You feel like you see a way through all this that perhaps bypasses the gulags.
Yeah, well, I've found faith. I think I just reached a point where I just couldn't think about it anymore, you know, and I was just like, ugh.
That's great. I haven't heard that word really since I heard George Michael on the radio.
Okay. You know. Well, you know, faith, desperation, it's the same thing. Maybe a space.
So where did the faith come from?
Through the path. And just learning not to think about stuff too much. And when I was thinking about it, it's just become clear. It wasn't a sudden swing.
Hmm.
It was just a gradual incremental, and I'd have sort of periods of like total terror where I would just surrender to whatever you want to call it, spirit or divine, and I'd just be, please help me align with whatever I'm supposed to do and just help me.
So it's like a bit like a form of prayer.
Yeah, no, I was literally
like a form of prayer
at the depth of my desperation. Yeah, I was on my hands and knees.
So you recommend that to other people as like?
Well, you can give it a shot. I mean, if it works,
the Muslims do it 5 times a day.
Well, you know, that's a bit excessive in my opinion, but I mean, if it works for them,
once a day, maybe on your hands and
knees. No, just when you know it's really bad.
But that's the interesting thing is it's a normal human impulse, and perhaps people in this day and age are repressing that, do you think?
Oh, totally. I mean, because it's this, for me, it came as a like a reaction to extreme anxiety I had. So when my sort of comedian path came to an end and I went through all my plant initiation stuff, then that identity was dead and that path was gone and I was kind of in flux. I didn't know what to do. So there's a lot of periods of just like, running around like that. And then eventually I was like, may as well just pray. Because at least it's a more positive way to sort of channel that.
So how many minutes a day would you pray for?
I'm pretty good right now. Right. I don't need God.
No,
so much
but when you were, when you were on your hands and knees, how many?
Oh, in the morning.
And how long for?
15. About 15 minutes.
Okay. Maybe, like, what was the the process? You were talking to God? Or?
Well, it changed. Firstly, when I had to abandon the comedy path, it was just show me my next path.
Right.
Please show me what I'm supposed to do.
Hmm.
And then I was kind of shown clearly that my path was a plant path. And so so then I was like going down that path for a while. And then, and then I had another period last year where that all sort of got turned on its head after my Iboga flood. And I thought that had come to an end as well. So then the next path was just like, next bit was just me surrendering to divine will. Cause I just realized I had to take myself out of the picture. Like the less involved in my life directly, the better it seems to go. Like I've been experimenting this year with just going out into the nature. And then I'd come back and I'd get all the emails and it would actually show me what the next few months was going to be like instead of me sitting in front of a computer panicking, going, oh shit, what do I need to force into existence? It was better for me just to go out into the bush and then things and get myself into alignment. So then the prayer was all about aligning myself to, divine will or whatever's that thing bigger than me.
So in that time period you didn't take plants, what were you doing and how did you see your future?
I wasn't really sure what my future was, but I was doing a lot of ayahuasca in 2017, 2018, and a lot of acacia and San Pedro. I was doing everything, and that was my main initiation period. And then I did the Iboga, and that showed me that I needed to stop, otherwise I was going to lose my mind. So then for the next 10 months, I was doing maybe 2 hours of Qigong in the morning and meditation and really just nothing. I was just trying to integrate that last 2 year period and trying to get back into my body because I was really out of my body and my boundaries were very thin. So I was just having to come back. So I was just literally doing a lot of Qigong, a lot of exercise. I've all of a sudden had a community of friends up in Darwin who were just regular people. That was very helpful. Like, you know, counselors and nurses and just regular people.
Mm.
And that was actually very grounding to have a support network and staying still, not moving around anywhere. And so, yeah, I was not really doing anything really. And writing, I was doing a lot of writing and sort of going through that whole period and trying to integrate it all.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so at what point did you decide that to ignore the directions on your wrist that says no more tripping or no mo tripping that the Iboga told you to put there and you actually start getting into it again?
Well, I made a brew for reasons I can't go into. And I was like, well, I have to try it, you know? I can't, I have to try this brew. But I kind of rationalized it to myself that towards the end of that 2018 period, I wasn't doing it for healing anymore. I was really just experience chasing and got stuck on the healing treadmill, you know, where I was like, oh, I have to heal this now. And I don't actually think there was many real healings towards the end of that period, though a lot of it was just a wild goose chase. So I just decided, oh, you know what, I think that was tripping, but I have a pretty good reason for this journey, which was to try the brew and to connect back to my heart, because I was very isolated last year as well. I think I had to be. And I just wanted to connect to my heart and, And then having said that, then actually I went down another bad place for a while. So that drinking actually, I realized was slightly ego motivated and that did lead me astray. And then I went down a dark path for a bit, but I was sort of...
You mean like hanging out in the cemetery...
getting lost again, trying to get back into the game, I was facilitating around 2018 as well, and I started facilitating again the next year, 2019, and I thought I could just start off where I left off on 2018, which I was drinking every week, and I thought I could drink with all the groups, and I ended up picking up a lot of energy off people, and I got involved with someone who I can't really go into, but they were, what I could only say, were possessed. They were carrying a nested entity that got into me and totally fucked me up for about 4 months. And then I kind of came good again this year when I got back on the Iboga. So I haven't really changed that much.
But I'm
getting milder.
So what do you think about... So people would... You said you had this experience of this entity, this attack from this woman,
yep,
presumably. And do you think that people experience this and have no context for what it is they're experiencing?
Oh, definitely.
And what do they think it is? Do they think it's just themselves?
Well, see, everyone's encountered a psychic vampire or an emotional vampire. Everyone's working with one, it seems. There's always seems to be someone who's an emotional vampire. And for me, this has happened to me twice now. I've seen entities in people in the medicine space, but also I've been out with two girls, and I'm sure it happens to women with men carrying entities, where I've been having sex with them, and I will see the entity in their face. And like, this is, because I feel like the field is down, the energy field is down, and like, I've literally had this one girl, like, hiss at me with vampire fangs, and I was like, oh god, no. And later on, she revealed herself to be an emotional vampire. She was literally draining me, and then I ended up going on a...
But you didn't pick it? You didn't feel drained at the time?
Well, I was, but I hadn't been with anyone for a while, because they hook into your weak spots, you know? So my weak spot then was just love and intimacy, and you know, I'd been celibate for maybe 8-9 months because I was really trying to do the medicine path straight, and all of a sudden, you know, she was really hot as well, and so I just let my guard down, and that's how they kind of get you. They sort of find your vulnerable weak spots. And
but you didn't, you know, after having that experience and after, you know, having a cigarette in bed, you're not like, shit, I feel a little bit drained, like something weird has gone on here.
Well, when you get drained, your level of consciousness degrades. So I feel like your awareness actually goes down. So you're kind of noticing it, but your willpower gets drained. And this is what I noticed with the next lady. And when the vampire lady, no offense, I went on a Chirksinango dieta soon after that. And on the first day of taking the master plant, I literally felt tentacles getting pulled out of my stomach, and I just realized, oh, it's over between me and that lady. That's not happening anymore. And I literally felt for the next few days those tentacles like sort of like snuffling around my stomach, like trying to find its old connection. But the plant had just come in and be like, no, that's not in your integrity, because it's meant to flush out anything that's not in your integrity. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of context for people, and there's a lot of material online about sexual vampirism and sexually transmitted entities, which I believe is a big thing that a lot of people don't actually realize is happening. I mean, I think that when you're going out with someone, you're also going out with their demons on some level, right? So sometimes your demons love each other probably more than the good parts of yourself, and that's the toxic relationship. So yeah, you got to be really careful now.
So can you think back to before you had this awareness of how this was, how this is reality for you? How do you remember what it was like to have these sorts of experiences and not have a context for it?
Yeah, well, I started thinking, man, maybe I have an entity in me that's feeding off women as well.
No, know? Say like years ago, like
how? Yeah, well, I'd get obsessed with girls, like on an unhealthy level. And I had this very interesting experience where the first girl I had a crush on, was Alice in Wonderland from the live-action Disney film in 1980-something. So I realized one day that I was subconsciously always looking for this weird archetype, Alice in Wonderland character. And I was at this festival in England, and this is what kind of revealed to me, and I'd taken a bunch of liquid 2CB, and you know when you're at a festival and you meet someone, you see your festival crush, and she's like this perfect... And I saw this girl, she's like this perfect fairy tale elf woman, Alice in Wonderland, and she was so beautiful, I couldn't talk to her, I was just too petrified. I'd you know, go out and I'd smoke a cigarette and be like, no, I'm fucking, I gotta do it. And I'd go in and just freak out. And then finally I was like, that's this shit. And I was like, just like, I'm just going to go to bed. And then I left and I was like, you know what? If I run into her once more, I would definitely talk to her. And I ran into her and I didn't talk to her and just felt like shit and ended up snorting myself into a K-hole to deal with that. And then in the morning, everything had worn off and I was back to sobriety and I went outside and I ran into her again and she looked nothing like my hallucinations. She was just actually, I didn't find her attractive at all. I found her quite unattractive. And I talked to her and we had nothing in common and I was so happy. I was almost...
Well, it's good you talked to her.
I was almost as happy as if she had been everything I wanted and I'd fallen in love. And I realized, oh shit, what is this thing I'm projecting onto? It's
projection. That's it. People say that a lot of people's, you know, that love itself is often a projection of the ideal. And also there's that I think men probably get this more with women than women get it with men.
Definitely.
That they have this, they project their ideal onto the woman and then they're like, no, I'm not worthy of my own ideal.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of that.
And then when they talk to them, they're like, oh, actually, this is a real human being, you know?
Yeah. But then, you can definitely see when women sense that. But also then, you know, I was reading about Jung's theory of the anima where it's like, man, am I just falling in love with some, is this Alice in Wonderland archetype just some split off part of my own psyche that I'm then throwing off into someone? So it just gets a bit weird really after a while.
So where are you at now in terms of the female of the species, as it were?
I'm very... Well, I identified my patterns, so I just don't want to do those patterns again. So, yeah. So, I have issues, Julian. I need to work them out. Well, yeah, I have anxious avoidant attachment style. So I need to find someone with a secure attachment style I can sort of sort this stuff out with. But that's not the pretext for a relationship. But unfortunately, what I've found is that most people with secure attachment style, they're all taken. They're all relationships now.
At 16.
At 16, yeah. And now they're just like, you know, got families and stuff. So now it's just like, I just want to go out with someone who doesn't have a demonic entity in them.
They're the leftovers.
But it's hard when, yeah, I mean, you know, you get to a certain age, you're like, why are you still single? Why am I still single? But maybe you find that, right? I mean, you have to be a bit more picky if you're doing medicine work, right? Because you're melding your energy with someone and you can't just, I definitely don't think I can just have one-night stands from Tinder anymore. Not that I ever did that, but I went on Bumble recently and I was just like, what is this? I couldn't meet anyone here. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I've always been sensitive, but I found that, you know, it can be, I think there's a lot more involved than our society recognizes that's involved in connecting to someone and actually taking on and processing their stuff and their karma and all different levels of the interaction, and also even their, you know, approach to sexuality, everything, you know.
Yeah.
So it can be quite intense, and I'm quite a sensitive new age guy, and I know a lot of other men who were quite sensitive, and it can be a real issue.
Yeah.
Like just that, just living in a society that doesn't have a context or understanding of what's actually going on here, you know. We really, and in which there's not really an established foundation for human relationships in our industrial global society in the first place.
So in like future utopia, what would that look like in your vision, like the ideal sort of relating sphere between partners?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because you asked me the other day what was the theme of my early journeys.
Mm.
That's what it was all about. It was all about that. And I could describe that as an understanding that there was much more to the interrelational sphere between humans, but especially between masculine and feminine.
Mm.
And I had an understanding or an awareness of this immense potentiality that we were not respecting or being aligned with or connecting with, and that this was, that there was a kind of a technological sphere that was that had not been activated within our society.
What do you mean by technological sphere?
Like, by technological, I mean that there was the interface was like technology.
Okay.
Right? So, but it wasn't technology as we know it, right? It was a different kind of technology that was that we didn't understand or know about.
Mm.
Like the first time I took the Syrian ruin acacia, I made this proclamation.
Okay.
We are the technology.
Okay. You know?
And I saw my higher self. I saw a higher self.
Yeah.
You can say, which was like a future version of me, which was a cross between a satellite and a supercomputer.
Okay.
And a flower.
Okay.
And
was there still like biological, organic?
Yes. Involved? Yes. Yes. And then after that experience, it visited me for the next day.
Oh, that structure.
Yeah.
Okay.
It would come to me, and I called it Julian 3.
Who's Julian 2?
I don't know who Julian 2 is, but it seemed like this evolutionary ahead of time somehow.
Yep, yep.
Version. So what I was going into at that time was becoming aware of the potentialities of the human species.
Mm.
And that was an interrelational field that was yet unexplored and understood.
Mm.
So I spent a fair bit of time exploring and understanding it. And looking at it from different perspectives and trying to understand why we were in this kind of because I would see that we live in a kind of deactivated
space. Yeah, yeah.
We're not actually living in our true balanced spiritual nature, you could call it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that what I saw was that there was an innate way, an innate path within the human organism. And it wasn't that the innate path or the innate way was a bit like, it wasn't like Eastern religion said it was, which Eastern religion says that you, it's a very much an individual quest.
Yeah.
Which, and it came out of these big civilizations like India, where you had these sort of pre-industrial civilizations and the, all, you know, the extension of the marketplace and all that. And, you know, you would be a householder and, you know, live your life and then, you know, you'd have children and then you'd retire basically and you'd go off into the forest.
Do the spiritual and stuff.
Do the spiritual stuff and attempt to attain enlightenment / realization. It's generally a male thing. But, you know, but there's all these different stories and then you have another aspect of that. You have you also have the tantrika couples as well.
Yeah.
Many different iterations that there's somewhere to go with that, you do it away from the world, right? So I had the understanding that it wasn't that what was sort of present to me that I became aware of wasn't that there was a state of being for me to kind of enter into or realized sort of enlightened place that I could just find refuge in or be in, and that would be, you know, happy days for me, right? And then I can ascend to the next level or whatever it is. This kind of, that I understood that the only real meaning or fulfillment of human existence was within a field of other human beings who were living living in a way where they were all connected to an interface which enabled them to live in such a way whereby they were fulfilled and happy in their beingness and were had an innate direction and, you know, I saw it at the time like a little bit like we still don't know how flocks of birds, they just move instantaneously. Yeah. You see the human species like that.
Yeah.
As that the humans, that there's like delicate, there's an interface where, which is likely metaphysical that enables birds to have that unified, that unity, a connection. So this was like something that became very obvious and evident to me that this was the answer.
What was not the answer?
That the answer was not the answer didn't lie in any kind of like personal sense.
Yeah.
But it the answer was in realizing and activating a greater consciousness, new language.
I get you.
Like a new language.
Yeah.
So, and I saw it as like, you know, like on the Georgia Guidestones, they say that.
What are the Georgia Guidestones?
You never heard of the Georgia Guidestones?
No.
Oh, really? So,
I mean,
Stonehenge in America. I think it was built in 1980. A mysterious man came forward with a large amount of money, and he built these sort of like Stonehenge-like structure in a few different languages, describing all these different. I think there's 10. Rules.
Okay.
And one of them is like live close to nature. Another one is maintain humanity's population under 500 million.
Oh, well, that's funny.
Another one is like, you know, maintain, I think genetic fitness. And the other one is unite humanity with a living light language.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, wow, whoever wrote that, some sort of like Rosicrucians or Masons or whatever, probably taking some acacia brew with DMT in it. Because you only see that kind of living light language that possibility with the tryptamines and that sense, you know, like they originally called ayahuasca, telepathy.
Mm.
And so you had this like, you had this sort of understanding of the possibilities of telepathy.
Yep.
So, yeah, at the time, I had a muse.
Okay.
Who was a homeless bag lady.
Okay. What was her name? How did you meet?
I met her. I was with my friend Daryl in the streets of Byron Bay.
Yeah.
And we're just sitting by a cafe. And she comes over and puts her bags down by our under our table and says, "Oh, I'm just going to put my bags here and come back in 2 seconds." And my friend Daryl was like, "What? That woman just said she wants to have sex with us?"
Well, was she pretty? I don't know.
Yeah, she was very pretty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She had incredible breasts.
Okay.
She looked like Kuan Yin.
Really?
Yeah, she looked like Kuan Yin.
Oh, wow.
But she had this real sort of upright poise.
Mm.
And she, all her clothes were in tatters. And she carried bags around town.
Okay.
And she was completely off her tree.
What was her name?
Inika.
Inka?
Inika.
Inika?
Yeah. So
where is she now?
You don't know. I believe she lives in Byron Bay.
Okay.
She still lives there.
As a bag lady or she's...
No, she got married, had children.
That's good.
But she was completely off her tree and she couldn't find anywhere to live because no one could live with her because she was so crazy.
Obviously that's changed.
But she was like, you know, very intimidated by me. And I was very intimidated by her, but she was my muse.
Okay.
I could see, I had this reflection of what I was going into as this potential I could see in her.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, possibly on one level, because she just, maybe she never had, maybe she just took acid once.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, you know,
had a spiritual,
just kept going.
Spiritual crisis.
Yeah, no, she just kept going.
Because
she just seemed to be continually.
Oh, she's always in that place.
She always seemed to be in that place.
Okay.
So, perhaps that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
But she was absolutely terrified of me. I was fairly terrified of her.
Yeah.
But I was, you know,
drawn.
I was fairly drawn to her. And I think a lot of people sort of witnessing this were sort of, were basically sort of, you know, amused by the whole thing. Because I was basically homeless as well.
Oh, okay.
I was taking acacia and Syrian rue like once or twice a week.
So where were you? Where would you live? Would you stay with friends?
Like, I'd stay with people.
Did you have
rent places?
Oh, okay.
I would camp at the beach, you know.
And you just, do you have a car? You're living out of your car or something?
Well, like, you know, we made friends with the local, one of the guys who had the local car agency.
Okay.
And I remember I at one point I was driving, I think it was the original Mazda 121.
Okay.
And it was called the poor man, it was a poor man's sports car.
Yeah.
But it was the car that his mechanic said to the guy who ran the car agency. He's like, "Andy! He's a German mechanic. You cannot let anyone drive that car. Somebody's going to die." So me and my friend Daryl, we just drive that car unregistered.
Okay. Yeah.
So I was pretty on edge at that time. But I was sort of, you know, experiencing all these weighty realizations about the world and existence. And I just lived in that place of just processing it because it was so deep and intense. All my experiences were so powerful.
So do you find like the brunt of your initiatory phase was in that period?
Yeah.
That was the main sort of unpacking.
Yeah, that was the main. And it was a lot of personal stuff.
Yep.
in all of that too, all the processing and a lot of meetings with beings, and I was in this magical place where I was fairly ungrounded.
I relate to that.
But I was, you know, it would happen that I have an experience and I'd just talk in poetry for the next 2 weeks. You know. I was fairly in that space.
I was
full time in that space.
That's pretty much what 2018 was like. You're in this sort of magical, everything's synchronicity all the time.
And I'd take like DMT and mokuamide and like go do it in the streets.
Okay.
Hyper amplified synchronicity. And life would become a musical which you'd interact with. You know? It was absolutely magical.
So I found, though, for me in that phase, it would definitely head into areas of complete delusion.
Yes. So this was like, this was a strange thing. It's like everyone else was like, okay, well, related to this woman, I felt that she and I were going to create, initialize somehow.
Yeah.
Some phase of humanity's evolution.
And was she in on it as well?
Well, that's the thing. I think on some level, you know, there was this deep recognition between us. And I think, like, you know, Disney movies, and I don't think it was like, it wasn't like I was in love with her. You know? But there, you know, there was love between us. There was obvious. There was a lot going on. But it was intimidating. And I think Disney movies might present the idea that often, you know, human relation, you know, like human love or relationships or the real thing is all just like sunshine lollipops.
I think
it brings up a lot of stuff. It's really confronting. It's very confronting. And it was so real and so intense. And I only saw this dynamic through the lens of a greater evolutionary
perspective.
And which is completely outside of the boundaries of any normal male female dynamic whatsoever.
That sounds like it's because what I went through was like this extreme ego inflation period that then collapsed in on itself towards the end.
Yeah. There is that too. You do get this like, that it's like, I think you've had this too. The plants are trolling you, telling you the story that you want to hear.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, you're being sort of dragged along. You're being, you know, pulled along by this line. And I had this, this sort of story. And I had this sort of like belief that there was going to be this manifestation between us. But then there wasn't, and the sort of final phase of this period started in January 2002.
Okay.
And I just came back to Byron Bay from, I think, Melbourne, some family Christmas, something like that. And I was at a friend's house, and she said, I met this amazing woman called Sarah Drew. And her resume was on the table. And I'm like, Sarah Drew? And I picked up her resume and my hand started shaking. And because I knew that I would meet this woman one day, because I'd read about her 6 years ago in a book by Douglas Rushkoff called Siberia, about the digital revolution.
Okay.
And I thought, like, wow, she's really out there, human being. You know, she talks about telepathy and becoming a cyborg and really pushing the boundaries of, like, psychedelics. And I remember reading it in 96 before I was even really taking psychedelics. And I knew that I would meet her one day.
Mm.
And this was in like San Francisco, this was all going on for her. And, you know, I remember the most striking part for anyone reading that book is the bit where she's in the recording studio and she says, "Oh, I'm a little bit flat today. I had an abortion yesterday and I took LSD before I went in."
Oh my God. Yeah, wow.
So this really kind of extreme person. And yeah, so I was quite sort of like, I think part of me knew.
Yeah.
When I picked up her resume. Oh.
What was she looking for a job in Byron for?
It was just, I think they were talking about projects.
Okay, yeah.
And stuff. And cut a long story short, she ended up living with my best friend, with her boyfriend at the moment, at the time,
yeah.
Who is actually became quite a well-known cult leader.
Oh, what's his name?
I probably shouldn't go into that.
Well.
And basically, it all kind of culminated without me having to do anything,
yeah,
really, with me and her taking an Acacia Flebophila brew on Mount Jerusalem.
Okay.
And that experience was the most intense experience of my life.
Out of all of them.
The strangest, really? Strongest, most crazy, full telepathy. They shot to the ends of the universe. The whole bonanza. And that after that experience and those days with Sarah Drew, it was like a complete affirmation.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I wasn't deluded after all that I'd experienced this interface with her. I'd experienced this dimension of telepathy and relationship in a way that I had seen, I wasn't just mad, right?
So that was like a distillation of the vision of in terms of the male and female.
Yes, it was like culmination of it was a culmination of that phase when I realized it was possible that I had in a way initialized something. Some process did go down.
Yeah, yeah.
With Sarah Drew and me on Mount Jerusalem. And so much so that towards the end of the vision, I saw this flying craft come down with a guy with like writing these scrolls.
Okay.
It was like writing it down in alien language, what was happening. It was newsworthy.
What was he saying?
He didn't say it. He didn't even look at me.
Well, what did the scroll
say? I couldn't read them. Yeah. But I can only imagine like what he would write.
Yeah.
But something had gone down that maybe he had some context or understanding of. I only experienced it.
Yeah.
And I knew that like it was super profound. It was super profound. And so after that, like everything sort of chilled out for me. There was no, I didn't need to struggle and strive. I'd sort of been.
You got the affirmation.
Yeah, I got the affirmation. I'd been sort of set free to you know, do whatever I did.
And then what? Just
and
sort
then,
of ground what you received over those
years. Yeah, and then that was like 2002. And then, you know, the next over, you know, the basically the you know the next year and the year after, that's when China came through.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was the.
So do you remember anything else which happened during that Flebophila journey? That really.
Yeah, but you know I remember a lot of it.
Yeah.
And it's like in hindsight, I really should have written everything down.
Yeah.
But I remember all the highlights.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's one of these stories that it's just really it's too hard to. Tell verbally because it's just too intricate and it involves such a context as well. But it was extremely strange.
Yeah.
And it was Yeah, it was revelatory.
Okay.
To me.
Yeah.
And affirming and super intense.
Mm.
And after that I made a website.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was, after that, I made a website and I kind of like felt affirmed in communicating what I'd understood as a kind of proclamation.
Yeah.
And it was like quite artistic.
Yeah.
And it was quite personal.
Yeah.
And much of it was, I wouldn't write that way about other people the way I would write now.
About Sarah.
About other people about as well. People. Yeah. And I would kind of, I would sort of, write about other people in a very personal way, write open letters to people and, I was very provocative.
Yeah.
And, I was a wild child, a lot of people didn't like that, and I understand that they didn't like it, But yeah, that website was, I think that was up for a few years.
Okay.
That website was I think I kept it up 5 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And I put all kinds of different things on there.
Yeah.
But the basis of it was an understanding that there was like a true dynamic or a true maybe that's not the way to say it, but there was like an essential sort of interface, technology, reality way inherent in humanity that
it's not being tapped.
We're not really embracing and allowing.
Yeah, so I feel like I received messages maybe during my third ayahuasca session, which involved this sort of narrative about a dark force of entities that were sort of keeping humanity down.
Mm.
And I'm taking that with a pinch of salt nowadays, but I do still see a lot of evidence that sort of definitely sort
Isn't
of...
Isn't that obvious that there's a bunch of entities keeping humanity?
Yeah, but then also I think within me, because I see the stuff that I'm supposed to do in order to, tap into this sort of higher place, and there's still some resistance. And I don't think that it can be accounted for. Some stuff I'm like, I feel like, yeah, I think that's the entity thing. And then other times I'm thinking, what's going on here? Why is there this block? Do you have any ideas on...
Because probably it involves like stepping up.
Mm.
And any time there's like the call to sort of step up, you have a sense that there's a great power and that there's that great responsibility as well.
Yeah.
And there's that
openness to attack as well.
Yeah. Do you think that? So you had this perception that there's these entities, but what's the calling that you've been called to do or step up into, or the tasks?
Yeah,
what you've been tasked to do.
Well, I mean, with the whole thing about the ego inflation during that sort of. Because I feel like there's a lot of people self-initiating right now, whether they like it or not. And I'd actually like to find out your views on... Because I was actually trying to find a lineage that I could initiate under, and I finally found a guy in America, and then he died of a heart attack. So I was like, oh, okay. And then the plant said, no, don't worry, you don't need that.
Here's the thing.
We'll sort you out.
Here's the thing. There's no such thing at like... There's no such thing as self-initiation, is only initiation.
Yeah.
Like, life is the initiatory process.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not like Yoda is holding the hand of Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
It's like he's got to go for his own story.
Yeah. But it helps to have someone who's been through a similar experience in somewhere.
Yeah,
in
but in that archetypal story,
yeah.
Yoda's more a provocateur.
Yeah.
And calling... calling Luke to step up and, you know, like, you know, bring the spaceship out of the mud and getting him to really step up.
Yeah.
But really, life is going to do that anyway.
Yeah,
which is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, it even occurs to me, like, even, like, you know, you meet all these 8th, 9th generation lineage holders, but then you're like, well, surely someone had... The first person in that lineage, he would have self-initiated, right? Or he would have initiated... How would that guy have come... Where would that guy have come out of?
It's fairly common that that these guys in Amazon, they just start off. Drinking ayahuasca and they start learning. And you learn in the field of the plants.
Yeah.
And then you have someone to talk to. Then you might have someone to talk to about who can say, oh, well, this is that that. Or you might not, you know. But does it really matter, like,
if no,
you
have
someone
so.
To talk to you
no,
about
no.
it?
I
because
think
when you get that, you have that connection to the gnosis. You called to get that connection
I think
to
it
the
helps.
Gnosis anyway.
But
here's the other thing, like, what tradition or what, you know, what tradition is there that for people like us, for mutants like us?
That's what I reckon.
I think, you know, we're creating the tradition, we're creating the culture.
Well, that's what I think as well. But I definitely feel like it's can be useful to have someone just to help explain what might otherwise be conceivably schizophrenia in this cultural context, and you know you can get put away. So yeah, and I feel and the messages I was getting was basically. Shit's going down. You guys have to wake up now. And you guys, me and my friends who were sort of going through these sort of initiatory experiences, you guys are kind of a little bit ahead of the curve and you got to help sort of, light the way for the others behind you. Not in a sort of egotistical way, but, yeah. And I actually don't think that's really that diluted now. I just didn't think it was going to happen this soon. Yeah.
So where do you feel you're at with that process?
I feel like I'm a bit more solid now than I was, say, last year. Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty good for now. But I was wondering, after your main initiatory phase, have you gone through any subsequent sort of initiatory phases after that, like secondary initiatory phases or...
Yeah.
Or big periods like that. Maybe they weren't as intense as the first one, but were they on that similar level of deepening?
Different levels. And a lot of it for me has been an understanding of what you can call the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, again, we've been programmed to have this sort of view that there's no such thing as evil.
Yep.
And I don't think we really know what it is we're dealing with in reality.
Yeah.
And so there's kind, you know, this kind of enlightened intellectual Western viewpoint.
Yeah.
This kind of like, it's actually pseudo-rationality.
Yeah.
It's not real rationality because it's very limited in the computational understanding of reality is very limited.
Yeah.
But in that perspective, it might be that, oh, there's no such thing as evil. There's only an absence of light, for example. When the nuts and bolts reality is, I would, that it took me some time to wake up to, is that humanity is... undergoing a parasitic infection.
Mm.
And these parasites that, you know, they do want to keep us down. They do want us to maintain a level of psychological, spiritual, mental, emotional ill health so that we remain their food.
Yeah.
And there is an absence of light in, they want to maintain the absence of light.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they can continue to feed on us.
And
so,
in your view, do you reckon this has been going on since the beginning of time, or do you reckon it sort of came in at some point?
I don't know. It's like this sort of understanding doesn't really, you know, I haven't been told that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I haven't got that download.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's almost like I think possibly because I had a substandard education, which I'm sort of happy about.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like that, I got no programming.
No
programming at all. You know, I went to a high school in Shepparton, Northeast Victoria, where you know the kids from other schools, you'd say you're from Shepparton, they just back away. it was an education where they don't really educate you or put anything in there, and they teach you the antithesis of curiosity, like how to be just completely uncurious.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
I think that's just the education
system. Yeah, yeah.
Ironically, actually, that's where I got this tattoo.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's right. That's right.
In your hometown.
No mo tripping. So related to perhaps my lack of curiosity comes from that, but it also I think comes from an understanding that you don't need to know everything. You don't need to understand everything. And
I've definitely got
and that. we're just where we are.
You'll never really know anyway.
Yeah, and you pick up little bits and pieces about how things are. Mm. But you know, as I think that and there's many different theories about humanity, you know, the understanding that the first civilization were the Sumerians and the Babylonians, and Babylon is often talked about being the kind of the evil, sinful civilization as a whole. It might have begun then.
Okay.
In that kind of that time when humans moved away from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle into the organization, and also that meant much more sophisticated warfare.
Mm.
And I think that say people who were out, or I shouldn't say out, but you know, people who were living in Europe, say 2,000 years ago, they were tribal people. They were probably we don't know much about them or how they lived. You know,
it was all destroyed. But
and their spirituality and their relationship to the earth and each other.
Mm.
But I suspect it was probably like fairly connected. It was probably fairly similar to how we understand the Aboriginal dream
time.
Native Americans, like past, present, and future is all one sort of thing.
You still see the traces.
Yeah. Like in, you know, you go to Stonehenge and they've got, you know, you go to those stone circles and they've got a spiritual power. Like it's really evident that that's there. And so were they being predated by these entities? I think that they weren't. I think they were being predated to some degree, but they weren't being farmed.
Mm.
And I think the farm being farmed happened when the agriculture
industrial thing.
Yeah, and then the people stayed still. They ceased to become, you know,
they got disconnected,
really. Much less nomadic. And there's a lot of old stories that talk about the compromises that human beings have made. There's a really interesting one where the devil says that comes to the farmer who's got to like mill his grain by hand with a you know moving the
mm.
the sort of stone by hand to mill the grain. The devil says, I can give you a machine that can do that for you. And the devil says, but I'm going to take your daughter's left hand
mm.
in exchange. And so the mill, you know, the miller sacrifices his daughter's left hand for the machine, so he doesn't have to work to mill the grain.
I wonder what that symbolizes.
So it's quite powerful. It's like the left hand is like the feminine motility.
Oh.
It's like the destruction of the goddess.
Yeah.
And then that, around that time, you have very much the female, like I've been to Syria, for example, in 2008. And there's incredible statues of old goddesses from those civilizations.
Like Babylon and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So they were worshipping more the goddess in those times. And there's some anthropologists who say that the people who lived in Europe way back when were very much more goddess worshipping, were not more like, that's all very contentious because we don't know.
Yeah,
but there's some theories about that. So it's like the ingression of the machinery and the technology, the external technology, you've got the disconnection of the goddess or his daughter is like, you know, subject to that have the potential to really grow into the full womanhood that she would have otherwise be able to. So there's a real sense that you know, our civilization has really, you know, lost the plot fairly early on.
Yeah.
And there's a really good book I recommend people to read called Civilized to Death by Christopher Ryan. And he talks about the myth that people who lived, the old ways, the tribal ways or Native Americans or Native people lived an inferior, more unhealthy and ugly, brutish life than civilized men. And, it's a really good read. He really explores that topic. So in terms of the entities, the beings, it seems that they sort of came online then.
Okay.
And began really farming us. And
I guess the more civilized we became, the more disconnected we became, and then it seems the more disconnected we are, the more open to manipulation or takeover or possession.
We become more docile. We become less wild.
You see that in the latest generations of humans, I think. It seems like every generation is getting more and more docile and sort of... maybe the next generation of kids will be different in reaction, but... Yeah, it seems to be less... Just put the head down and sort of... So with your with these secondary sort of initiation or initiatory phases, it's more just an expansion of your initial sort of...
It's not really an expansion. It's something totally different.
Oh, it's totally different.
Yeah, you don't really know. But for me personally, it was important that the first initiation, I suppose, was just coming to terms that these beings existed in the first place.
Yeah.
And if you can't acknowledge that there's no other form of sentient existence,
you
can't have a spirituality
in the
first place. There's nowhere to go.
There's
nothing there, right? So you're in the Western default nihilism.
Yeah.
And we come, in a sense, I came from the default nihilism.
That's where I came from as well.
And because that's the default program. And the default nihilism, and you see all these extraordinary entities and you're just like, can't really, you know, it's so real at the time.
And then
you sort of come back and you're like, it's hard to explain them away, but you're not convinced.
Yeah.
So what I said at the time, so I remember I gave a talk at Entheogenesis 2002.
Yeah.
And I said it was like after the 660th time.
Yeah.
Your mind stops protesting.
Yeah.
The beings are real, and you acknowledge their reality and their existence, and you just accept that they're real.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the first level. And I think there's a lot of politics related, and I think related to human beings, because that's the first step to really waking up, to understanding. Yeah,
yeah. What's your opinion on, like, the non-dual folks who say, oh, it's just a...
Well, that's a really interesting thing is, like, when I was into all that stuff in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Like, I was connected to... I was hanging out with all those folks in the early noughties too. It's not like they were my homebrays. Yeah. Like, they thought I was, in that case, like everyone else. But, like, I was friends with a lot of those people and hang out with a lot of those people. Yeah. And, like, yeah, it's a useful model of reality to an extent, to have an understanding that reality is non-dual. Yeah. And I suppose for me, perhaps that was the first level. And I experienced the first initiation. And I experienced that before taking psychedelics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And having these spiritual experiences of just seeing everything unfold and
just be connected.
And fold into light. And
just spontaneously?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, okay. Yeah. And just have these sort of experiences. And also with friends at that time who were into this stuff.
Yeah.
There was a level of recognition and namaste, honoring the divine within. And having that ability to sink into that place where you're able to be in that space with another human being. So that was something for me that was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
But it's not an adequate explanation for everything.
I feel like it's just one model of reality.
Yeah, it's just a model of reality.
That's great for one thing, but...
Yeah, it's great, but at that time, say around Byron Shire, which is like... At that time, in the early noughties, it was all like poor people.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It was all poor people living... A lot of people hitchhiking around, just, you know, people who dropped out, who...
Yeah.
A lot of people prayed and meditated. There was magic in there.
Yeah, I went up there for school. He's the first time around then.
Mm. And you know, that dissipated quite quickly. I'd say around 2001, 2002, that sort of really dissipated. Mm. But so there was a lot, at one point, I think there was like a dozen, two dozen people giving satsang, which is where, you know, you have this contemplation into truth and... and a lot of these people used to take psychedelics as well. People like Isaac Shapiro, that's fairly well known, you know, Advaitic sort of dude. Me and a friend, we made a website for one of these guys called Vartman.
Okay.
Who went on to become a, you know, infamous tantra teacher. And, you know, went to 2 days of his retreat. And so I knew a lot of these people, hanging out with these people. And I think it was interesting. David Deida came around.
This is really?
David Deida came around. And I remember it was $20 to see him talk.
Oh, okay.
And we thought that was a lot of money
at
the time. and then he started talking about fucking people to God. And it all just dissipated. It was really
the
weird.
Arrival of David.
It was the David you came along. I was like, oh wait, like let's just fuck each other now. Like we give up all this Advaita sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to be going anywhere. There's a limited sort of. You couldn't really take it anywhere too much. I mean, it's like a good foundational understanding. It's a bit like, you know, some breakthrough smoke of 5-MeO or something.
That.
But it's not. You know, it's like, but 5-MeO is not all there is either.
Yeah.
It's like you smoke 5-MeO and it's like, oh, it's all one, so, you know, it's divine consciousness, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the end all and be all of what reality is.
Yeah.
It's just one aspect or level or phase or, you know, I think that's kind of incomplete description because it doesn't acknowledge duality.
And
duality is our experience. And you can say, oh, duality is just an illusion. But it's not really...
It's a very convincing illusion.
An illusion. It's a reality, I think, that we've created.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a reality, reality that consciousness has created to experience itself.
Mm.
You know? Because just as it's amorphous sort of singular blob,
yeah,
it doesn't know who it is. It doesn't understand itself.
Mm.
But in the realm of duality, it can understand itself. It can love itself.
Yeah.
It can realize itself as it is. So I suppose, like, what I was understanding was, oh, there was a way that humanity could realize and love itself and be itself. Mm. Something like that. I was really...
And do you think there's any... Because people always... I guess the non-dual state, which people achieve through 5-MeO or super high doses of DMT. But what I found from my experiences in them is I'm not there anymore, so I don't remember anything. But I feel like some kind of unconscious processes have gone on underneath that. But what's from your experience of this, what do you reckon the benefits that you get from going to these states... If it's worth going there repeatedly, or if it's just something you go there a few times and then you're like, okay, that circuit's been sort of popped open.
Yeah, I think it's worth going there once.
Yeah.
For some people.
Yeah.
And it can be good. But I don't think it's necessarily useful to go there repeatedly.
Yeah.
I used to go there with high dose, really high dose ayahuasca.
Yeah.
But only for a lot of torment and suffering and craziness.
Yeah.
And kind of being like having a, you know, being defeated, you know, being destroyed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was nothing left. And then I'd sort of die.
Yeah.
And then I was, you know.
Were there any benefits to that?
Not really. I don't think there is. I think it's more useful to have an understanding of who you are
as
a human being.
And how you react.
I think there's all this emphasis on samadhi within Eastern religious and realizing the divine. And when you have this sort of samadhi experience by smoking 5-MeO or what have you,
yeah.
It's like, okay, well, there's that. We've got to get back to living and being humans.
Yeah.
And that's what I was really hung out. So what's this really about? What are we really doing with this?
Yeah, yeah.
Experience, how are we really going to live? Because it's like, all right, well, that's just there, but it's not boring, but it's a priori. It's always existing and always is going to exist.
I guess you can get into the trap of seeking the peak experiences all the time.
I have heard of this happening with people smoking the bufo like crack. To just have this spiritual bypassing,
yeah.
And they're just like, oh, it's all love and light and wonderful, and then really not truly addressing the nuts and bolts, human realities and dualities that are going on.
So, shifting a little bit, I was just wondering.
Wait, I'm gonna take a piss. All
right. Should I pause it?
No, don't pause it. Just keep it on.
Okay. Oh my god, have we been going for an hour and a half?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Maybe we go for half an hour.
I didn't even get to any of my questions.
Oh, you can start now.
Okay. We could do a second one in the morning. Or is that going to be too much for everyone? So, I was just wondering, how has drinking the medicine changed for you, like, because you've been doing it for, like, so long? Like, what are your reasons for drinking it now? And do you see an end point?
Well, I haven't really drunk for a while. And when I do, I often find myself involved in various battles with entities.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what it's about now. And that can be, you know, it can be quite fun. And there's nothing wrong with it. You know, inherently there's nothing wrong with it. It seems to be some sort of... Yeah, there's a kind of ongoing battle with entities, and my approach is largely to not prod them too much, to kind of leave them alone as much as I can.
Yeah.
And but if they come for me, I'm going to get them.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Do you still get insights or find information or get downloads that way?
I haven't... Because there's so much warfare going on.
Okay.
There's not much space.
So do you get any... Because I don't really get that. Yeah, I haven't... I've only really had it once.
In general, have downloads and stuff like that.
No, I don't really get the entity battles. And I hope I don't, to be honest.
Right. Well, I didn't get it for a long time.
Is it? Okay.
But then I started being able to kill them.
Okay.
And then when you start to kill them, they get upset.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They you know, when their friend dies, they want to take revenge.
Does anyone else that you know who's like a long-term medicine person have a similar experiences where they're just sort of killing things constantly, like battling?
No, not that I know of in the West or in Brazil or in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure there are, you know, shaman curanderos in Peru or whatever.
Yeah.
They're always battling entities.
And do you get, like, when you're battling these entities and you are able to sort of overcome them, do you get, like, personal power increases from that?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. You do. It's like a video game.
Yeah, yeah.
You do get the genies opening the bottle. You do get. It's like as below.
Yeah.
You know, as below, so above. It's like back in the day when the you know, if you performed well in battle, the king might give you a title and a
name. Yeah.
And you would become much more esteemed within your society.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I've experienced that.
Okay.
As well. It's like you get given good luck.
Okay.
You can get good luck. You can, it's like what we would call good luck. But we don't have much of a language for what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
There's all kinds of rewards. But it's on a spiritual level, there's all kinds of rewards. But there's all kinds of things. There's the bad things too.
So when you have been, when you have, I assume there's been malaise with these entities where they've gotten the better of you.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, you can get quite taken over. You can get quite possessed.
Like, can you describe one of these situations where you got possessed and how you managed to stop that?
Well, it generally ends when the experience ends. I've never had it keep going.
Oh, okay.
That which is the good thing about it. And it has only happened to me twice in the last 6 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's rare. It's like going crazy, which is like what madness is. It's like being possessed. But the thing about these entities is they don't want to, you know, the ones that I deal with, they just make your life a torturous living hell for all the time that they're fucking with you.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't want to live, they probably can't live with you all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know? Certainly, I think there are some that could and do.
Yeah.
And I certainly think that they could cause a heart attack or they could cause a stroke. They've told me that. It can get really painful if I don't defend myself. Like they put their claws in, like they can, you know, stop your heart or you know, shut down your system.
Yep, yep, yep.
Stuff like that. So yeah, they can kill you. They can make you go mad if they really want to, and they have power. You know, one of them told me, It was one of the ones who was a bit more, you know, up in the hierarchy. I think perhaps on a subconscious level, they can make people do what they want them to do.
Yeah, yeah.
How's that? Yeah. They can kill people.
Yeah, yeah.
They can give them a heart attack.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, make them go crazy or whatever they want to do.
Mm.
So, you know, the way that they see us, they see that they own us.
Yeah.
They see that they rule over us, that we do what they say.
Yeah. And have you ever had messages from, actually just from any of the entities, or even just from, like, I guess one of the big things with the medicine path is trying to work out what information you're getting is true and what's kind of noise. Do you have a sort of way of separating the noise? And also, have you been led completely astray before, like on wild goose chases?
Yeah, to some degree.
Yeah.
Nothing's coming to mind, but yeah. I know that it has happened.
Yeah.
What did you say previously related to that?
Just being led astray, like how do you separate the signal from the noise?
I think it's a matter of discernment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, how do you know, like, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys?
I guess you get...
You need to be vigilant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And pay attention. Yep. And really look and use your intuition and really feel into to the messages you're getting.
Mm.
You know? It's in the video game, yeah, there's times where you do get led astray.
Yeah.
And you do get deceived and you're like, oh fuck, and then you have to do
it. But I feel sometimes it's educational, it's like purposeful.
Yeah.
For
safeguarding
its future.
Yeah, it has been, I guess, for the last 5 years or so. There has been a lot of
just battling
these entities, and other stuff has happened too, but not that much. Okay. Because it's just become quite overwhelming.
So you feel like you've kind of stabilized to some degree?
I've stabilized to some degree. I feel there's a little bit of a truce. Okay. Between me and them, as it were. So I'll leave you guys alone if you leave me alone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's like there's a lot of, there's an understanding that I can create a lot of change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the world. Because that parasitic, I can clear parasitic infection, but... In parts of the world, in how they operate through people, or clear sort of families of parasites.
Yeah, yeah.
And the ones who are coming for me are often the ones who I think are really. Well, you know, from my perspective, they're the ones that are the problem for me.
Yeah,
they,
yeah.
They have their eye on me, you know. So I sort of feel my path is made clear.
Yeah,
By getting rid of them. But I feel like I'm, to some degree, helping humanity. But I feel also not, because I think that people create the conditions for these entities exist. Yeah. And that, you know, you can just kill some and other entities can just come and take their place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's...
I find that on some level with the facilitation stuff as well, like how even using, you know, all these plants as ways to sort of wake people up, like I feel like it's not a foolproof mechanism, and I've wondered, have you been noticing any differences over the years as you facilitated, like in terms of using these plants as sort of consciousness raises?
It's got a lot smoother.
It's got a lot smoother.
Yeah, it's got a lot smoother. It's got a lot easier. And I think possibly because many more people are doing it now, kind of morphic resonance, as people just snap more easily.
Yep.
It's not such a shock to the system.
Yeah.
That because so many people are having these experiences now, and they've read about it, it's been talked about, it's in all the newspapers, it's in the movies, it's people can assimilate it more easily now. So I mean, I think the plants just do work helping to align the human organism.
Yeah,
you know, and it's sometimes some people, I think the people have the potential to wake up.
Yeah.
We'll wake up anyway.
Yeah, eventually.
You know, yeah, it's like the plants are just the catalyst, as it were. And, you know, yeah, it's completely foolproof. Like, it's just a tool.
Yeah.
And people are just learning how to use it.
Mm.
They're just learning how to use it. And, yeah, it can catalyze some of your potentials. But it's... You know, it's a long process to really understand how to be in those states. And I think the one thing I have mentioned in my articles, and just to kind of get rid of all the obvious psychological shit that's in your way, and just see that that's a problem that you've got to deal with. That's where a lot of people are at, and that's fine. That's just the stage humanity's at. And you know, if people would only, sit still in a room with their thoughts.
Yeah.
Which, you know, lockdown has made a lot of people do. And it just deal with themselves. Just sort themselves out. And it's simple stuff. And I think that, ayahuasca can help people to realize the importance of doing that and how they can go about it. And then the processes that you learn in those states can carry over into your everyday life.
Yeah.
And you can sort the wheat from the chaff, and you can realize what you need to do and to live a more conscious life.
Yeah.
So, no, it's far from foolproof, but it's pretty all right.
Yeah.
It does a pretty okay job in really bringing people out of a quagmire.
Yeah.
And bringing them into a more, hopefully a more aligned, like having a greater awareness essentially reality.
Yeah.
In a spiritual sense.
Is there still stuff that has not been able to be sort of addressed through the plants, or stuff that you're still struggling with after being on the path?
Yeah, but that's a whole conversation. But there are things, but they're all compartmentalized.
Okay.
And, you know, they're just how they are. But on one level, I feel like I got to a point, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago, when there wasn't any obvious stuff that was coming up.
Yeah.
Was just personal psychological stuff that I need to look at.
Yeah.
And after that, I was like, all right, fist pump. It's been almost a couple of decades and I got to that point.
Okay, wow.
You know. So you would expect it to take that long.
Yeah.
That is like, okay, no obvious psychological bullshit is coming up.
Yeah.
And in my everyday life, it's not like there's psychological bullshit coming up for me all the time.
Yeah.
Because you kind of learn how to sniff it out and weed it out deal with it. And hopefully the plants will let you do that.
Yeah.
So that you're not suffering and neurotic and just kind of enmeshed in your own swirling, washing stuff. So people ask me, all right, what do you got for the plants? Yeah, I've got that. When I'm not, you know, causing suffering from myself, I'm not confused. I used to be confused all the time. I didn't know what to do, how to be, where to go, what to do. Now I'm kind of clear. I just know. I don't need to think about it too much.
Was that during the main sort of brunt of it all, when you were confused, or?
Well, during that whole initiation phase, I was confused then. I think confused is quite an interesting word, because it's sort of like con means together, and it's like fused as well. It's sort of like... but you learn to sort of sort things out.
You learn to
separate things and put that there and understand that lives there. And you, I think I think you learn to, let things be and hopefully be more at peace. So, I think in that phase when I was really quite crazy.
Yeah.
And when I would often just let it all out.
Yeah.
And I was...
What, just let it come out?
Yeah, let it come out.
Get expressed.
Yeah, let it get expressed. I'd even, at one point I was, taking DMT and acacia, and I'd let people watch me while I was in the state.
Like what, just go, hey, come around and watch Julian for...
Yeah, I put up posters around town.
Really?
By my bed. Yeah.
What would they say?
The only people who came were my friends. The only people were interested in my friends. I actually did have friends.
What would the posters say? Like, 8 p.m. tonight.
As I recall, it was like tripping with totality. But I remember I came across some people reading it and they thought, oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one came. Only my friends came along.
Okay. And did they trip as well? They just watched?
They just watch. They would come and go. I remember there was only really a couple of friends who were that interested. Yeah. And speak with me. But I would just let it hang out and I'd scream and I'd shout and I'd exclaim lots of mad things and I didn't hold back.
Yeah, okay.
And so there was a kind of like a purge.
Yeah.
This madness from me.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't feel mad. I feel really sane.
Okay.
I feel really sane. And if there's any, like, if someone thinks I'm mad, like, they're just projecting their inability to own their own insanity.
Yeah, well,
and projecting that onto me.
I think madness is all pretty subjective, but that's a pretty, popular saying.
But I think,
Was there any moments where you felt, man, I think I've actually fucking lost my mind and I need to get help?
No, there wasn't
any
moment like that. No, because there was...
You never had help trips where you, like... Because I've had where I'm like, I don't know if I'm coming back.
Yeah, I've had that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm not like, oh, I've got to go to the mental hospital now and, like, they're going to give me drugs and that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I never had that.
Okay.
Yeah. I never really, never went to that level.
Never went up to people in the cafe and left your bags underneath the table. I'm really curious to see how that lady sort of grounded herself in the end.
Yeah, no, I sort of found it online. She's very grounded, and I actually helped her to ground.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So she eventually really got it together after that phase. Around the same time, she really got it together.
And was there anything you were doing integration-wise that helped you pull everything together?
Well, because... I was kind of living on the dole.
Yeah.
I was working on my writing. Mm-hmm. I write like very obscure nonfiction, philosophy.
Yeah.
And my own writings about my experiences that I post and send to people.
Mm.
Before I had a website, I just had a little list of people I'd send them to. And because I didn't... I had a lot of time.
Yeah.
I had time to really think about, contemplate. And, it was slightly easier to be on the dole.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's easy again now.
Yeah.
I know, you can get back on the dole if you wanted to.
Yeah, I heard that. So, yeah, it was... Because I was full time, really.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too hard to integrate.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would talk to friends and some of whom were in a similar, not exactly the same, who understood what I was saying.
Yeah.
So it was a powerful time.
And what about, I feel like you've taken some pretty obscure plants and obscure combinations. I remember you telling me about this African plant that you reckon was as powerful as ayahuasca and a boga.
Oh yeah, bufane distichia.
Yeah, I'm just curious what that was like and how it could be that popular. And if it was like, was it like a tryptamine type thing? Or
no, it's like a big onion.
It's like a big onion.
Yeah, it's a huge, big onion. Like,
and what, you just chomp on it?
No. You got to cook it up and prepare it.
Okay.
And I was fascinated by it. All the African people, all the white African people I spoke to were scared of it. And the ones who taken it said, yeah, it was like, it's not like tripping normally because it becomes real and you think it's real.
Oh,
it
sure.
Sounded more like Datura.
Yeah. Do you know what were the active ingredients?
Oh, it's like bufanadrine.
Bufanadrine.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's very particular. And the Africans, the black Africans, they use it. I know this guy and his teacher would use it to...
Like spiritual teacher.
Would use it to find things.
Okay.
For divination.
Yeah.
To find out stuff. And they would also give it to schizophrenics.
Okay.
For schizophrenia. And I think in South Africa now, there's a big market for it because for the black people, all the various tribes, they will pay $200 to take it.
Oh, really?
And to meet the ancestors.
Oh, is it ancestral plant?
No, not strictly. So when I first took it, it was actually an Africana guy who just brought it to one of my ayahuasca groups.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, fuck, I have to take it now. He just collected it. He found it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I just cooked it up. And I found this bunch of adventurous people.
Yeah.
And we all drank it at the same time.
What did it taste like?
And it tastes chemically. It's like white, milky chemical.
Okay.
They're like MDMA.
Okay.
And initially, it felt like MDMA.
Wow.
As well. I was like, whoa, this is really good. It's like, ooh, it's quite intoxicating and nice.
Yeah.
And then we all started seeing the same things. We started going into a trance state at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we all... Are you seeing what I'm seeing? We're also in the ape, monkey people. Okay. You seeing that too? Yeah, ape, monkey people, and we're all...
What, in the room with you?
No, in the visionary trance.
In the visionary trance.
So and then we go into it, and then we come out of it, and then talk about that.
Yeah.
So there are phases. And then I remember we coming out again. It's like, did you just see that? It's like, yeah, I saw the ancient civilizations.
Okay.
You know, one woman particularly was really going into the ancient civilizations. And then we'd see the perspective of Africa.
Okay.
From the animals.
Oh, okay.
You know, from the buffet and showing all the animals.
I've had that on a boga.
Right, right.
Like I've had the, like just seeing the animals.
Yeah, from the perspective of the boga.
Well, I just have like, I'd see like the gorilla, like the face of the gorilla.
Right.
And I get the feeling as well, like a really primal energy. I've never been to Africa, but I got this like energy of the Africa.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the giraffe would come into my sort of field of vision and then like all the animals of the sort of the jungle.
Yeah. Well, we all experience the animals, but from the ground level.
Okay, yeah.
And we're like, okay. And then we saw the procession of the Bushmen.
Oh, okay. And were they the traditional?
They're the indigenous people of Africa who would have been the first up
people.
Until 500 years ago, I think. They were the people living in southern Africa. Before the Bantu came, before the Africana, the white Africana.
And they're the ones
came.
Who were probably using the bufane.
Yes. Okay. So we don't know how long they lived there for, but it was showing them, like showing a bushman hunting, you know?
Oh, okay.
And we'd all see that. And then we saw, like, and then the bufane would show us this humanity, would show, like, but it wasn't the man. It was, like, women washing clothes.
Okay.
Children playing in the water.
That's
just this really beautiful, but it was all black people.
Yeah.
And then the Bufang started. I remember the Bufang was showing me all these images of white people.
Okay.
And the white man had his kind of, the black man was a table, and the white man came and put his feet on the table. And so the Bufang showed me all these images of the white conquering consciousness and the colonial consciousness. And I wouldn't say the Bufang was racist, but it's certainly all the incredibly artistic imagery it showed us was just like, you know, was almost incredibly sarcastic.
Okay.
You know, it was quite condemning.
Yeah, yeah.
And critical of the white man's consciousness. But it is very easy to be critical of the white man's consciousness in South Africa.
How long did it last?
Oh, I think it was just a couple of hours.
Oh, just a couple hours.
Yeah. Okay. And then I did it again. And it was much more. Well, I talked to a Sangoma woman, and she said, "Did you see the ancestors?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't see the ancestors." Then the next time I did it, I went back to the place in the country where I showed these guys how to prepare it, and that's where we took it.
Yeah,
and they gave me some that they prepared.
Okay.
And I was seeing all these people.
Oh, well, this is the native people gave you something?
No, they were white.
Yeah.
Most of the white Afrikaners. Afrikaners. And I had these visions of these people, but they were quite small.
Okay.
And they were European looking, and they were all looking at me, and I'm looking at them. I'm like, what's all this about? And I had these like quite trippy visions, and things started to be quite real. It was sort of quite impersonal.
Okay.
It wasn't so personal. So, yeah, after the first experience, the Bufang said, "I don't want to be sold on the internet."
Oh, okay.
You know. So it's one of these things, and it's not like white people in South Africa are really getting into it. And the guys who had done it quite a few times said, one of them had this experience where he experienced being raided by the cops as if it was real.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Wow.
Absolutely vivid.
Is it against the law, though?
No, but he experienced...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As
a little lesson.
Not against the law, but he experienced being raided by the cops.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely vivid. He said it was absolutely... And the second time I did it, I was like, wow, this stuff is so powerful. And it didn't seem to have... The first experience was so friendly.
Yeah.
And, you know, showing us its perspective and what it's seen. And then it kind of showed me what it could show you.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, this could really open up. And it didn't seem to have any healing element.
Oh, okay.
No, it didn't seem...
It was more like... Information.
It was like information, like you use it to find out things.
Okay.
And it started to tell me things, and I could understand. I could understand what different people think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you can sort of see reality more easily and more clearly. So it was a very interesting plant, and I don't think it is going to be sold on the internet anytime soon. Mm. But apart from those guys, no one's picked it up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As far as I know, people are scared of it, and it's. I don't think many people have really explored it that much.
But it's in a class of its own, basically. There's no, it's not a tryptamine. It's not a
It's its own phenethylamine
or anything like
that.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And so it's not endangered. There's quite a lot of it about if you know where to go.
Yeah,
but there's
not
that much landscape.
No, I was just curious about it because of your work. Uncovering new and
exotic. But I don't know how useful it would be for your average man on the street. They wouldn't find much benefit in it.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed like just like this is a shamanic. It's just it does seem that it is for the shamans or the Sangomas, as they call them in South Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tool that they use, and possibly it would be good for schizophrenics.
Mm.
But yeah, if you know, there was some right here, I'd probably get to it eventually. You know? But there's no.
Well, I have some in my bag.
I mean, no great hurry.
Yeah.
To explore it, but it would be interesting to, you know, what would be the chemical analogs. That would be scary.
Or even what the active constituents are like. I've never even heard of this. Bufandrin.
Yeah, Bufandrin is the one I remember. Yeah.
Well, what about combos? Do you have any weird ass combos
that I recommend? Are good? Well, yes. Well, I mentioned that in my book, Articulations.
Oh, okay.
Like DOI and ketamine, for example.
DOI.
Yeah, or 2CB and ketamine.
Oh, I mean more plant-wise.
Oh, right. Plant-wise? No, generally don't combine plants. Yeah, just stick with one. Like, I'll just go with one. Ayahuasca and mushrooms is very good.
You know?
Or, you know, as you know, you use an admixture plant. It becomes the psychoactive plant that you use.
Yeah.
So you can make any plant.
I remember you sharing I can't remember that herb that I had the tea and you were talking about how you put that in a brew. Have you worked much with non-traditional ayahuasca admixture herbs?
A little bit, and I got into it and I got a little bit burnt.
Because
some of the brews I made were a bit too strong.
Oh, okay.
And they made an imprint, like they branded the brain in a way. And so,
which plant was that?
I don't even know the ID.
Okay.
You know. But I found this plant on top of the hill that I'd never seen before. And it had this huge, like, rainbow-coloured, like, it's like eucalyptus, huge rainbow-coloured leaf.
Okay.
And I was like, wow, that would be really cool in the brew. So I just put one leaf in the brew.
Yeah.
It's too strong.
Describe this imprinting effect, like.
The whole of my dreams for the next year were kind of, I was seeing the world sort of through the lens of this plant.
Oh, okay.
And not in a good way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What do you mean in this sort of forced?
Yeah, and had kind of affect it biochemically.
Yeah.
That there had been an imprintation that perhaps wasn't positive.
Okay.
That perhaps combining that plant with the ayahuasca and the ML inhibitors maybe wasn't a good idea. And it was really strong.
How did you recover from that? It just happened naturally.
Yeah, it just took time.
Well, you never really have.
maybe you never have. Yeah. So after that, well, I got the download, really, hey, don't just chuck plants in as an admixture.
Mm.
You really got to make, are they suitable to be used as admixture? And is it biochemically going to be okay?
Mm.
That's why it's easier to just go with the Amazonian plant.
Yeah.
But I was telling you about Epilobium parviflorum.
Yeah.
It worked fantastic. It's one of the two main herbs for the male prostate that are known in the West. Is salt palmetto and Epilobium parviflorum.
Yeah.
It's an ayahuasca admixture. It's absolutely incredible.
And you put salt palmetto as well?
I haven't done that.
Okay.
But you know, it's like the, for men, the prostate's like the womb for men.
Yeah.
And using Epilobium parviflorum was like pure prostate healing.
Oh, okay. Maybe I should give that a shot. So, what's the score?
Are you talking about COVID-19?
Yeah, I'm just interested in what your take on the whole schmozzle is.
The way I see it, I think it's like we're talking about a story that's unfolding.
Yeah.
And I believe that it appears to me that there's much to this story that is yet to occur. Mm. But it appears to me that in the greater story, you can call it like the apocalypse, which means, I'm sure a lot of people know it means to reveal, to uncover.
Mm.
I think that this COVID-19 story is the first chapter. It's the first sign. It's the first because it's revealing a lot of things to a lot of people.
Yeah.
A lot of people are understanding a lot of things about our reality and about themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when it first hit in mid-March, I could feel the collective people were suddenly had this instant, oh my God, everything I've been doing is pointless.
Yeah, yeah.
And this real sense of their mortality and a real, it kind of clicked into, okay, what does really matter if I can't just keep scamping around and in this game, which suddenly doesn't make any sense and doesn't have any meaning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So everything, I think, so much was put in stark relief.
Yeah, yeah.
And highlighted, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, and just the fragility of what was assumed to be a solid system.
That's right. And, like, those of us who stopped, been on the dole, and thought about things, like, we know that it's fragile and that there's many aspects to it that are dysfunctional. And there are many very weak links.
There's heaps of weak links.
And say with Victoria, for example, was like all those, just one of those, two of those weak links
in the
returning travelers in the hotel has caused this lockdown crisis in Victoria, in Australia. So I think it's really allowed people to see what's going on and maybe to take things a bit more seriously, maybe to wake up and get their priorities straight and really have a look at what we're facing because, I mean, I don't have a clear understanding of what's going to unfold, especially over the next couple of decades.
Yeah.
But I think the next couple of decades are going to be very interesting. And I think we're going to see other chapters. I think we're going to see a story unfold a bit. We're going to have some, we're going to see an unfoldment of consciousness. We're going to see more people wake up.
Yeah.
You know? So I find this whole sort of anti-authoritarian stance related to COVID-19 quite juvenile and boring and unnecessary and pointless.
Well, I feel like that reaction is, well, the system is quite parental in a way.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's a natural reaction to the nanny state, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's the first phase of response to like, fuck you, mum, fuck you, dad.
Yeah.
And then we'll see where that goes. Dad and mum, government might just be like, shut up and smack us really bad. And then, I don't know, we'll see who still wants to yell at their parents.
That's right. That's right. So really, you know, I think we really got to think about tyranny.
Yeah.
We're going to think about tyranny because as we've been talking about, the tyranny is not the government. The tyranny is not the corporations. The tyranny is not the deep state.
Well, that's just a byproduct of the tyranny.
Yeah.
Expression of the tyranny.
Like I was talking about the parasitic infection, the tyranny is actually these huge cockroaches.
Yeah.
These huge lobsters, these huge obscene alien creatures.
You, as in like the entity, dark entities,
who are really behind the tyranny.
Yeah.
And some of them are very intelligent.
So what do they get out of this, the power thing and the food thing?
They just survive. They just feed.
Is it just their program that way?
I don't know if they're programmed that way. It's like is a lion just goes out and hunts and eats food, right? But who programmed them?
Or who created them?
Who created the lions?
The giraffes.
What?
Sorry, no. That's a bit stupid.
Yeah, it's like, because we don't know who created us. Yeah. We don't know who created the lions. How can we know who created them? But I would say, I don't have any anger towards them because they're just like the lions. They're just doing their thing. They're playing their part. They're doing their thing. And it's almost like if we're going to live in such, it's like, which came first?
Yeah.
The denuded sort of collapse or dysfunctionality of our spiritual nature.
Yeah.
Or them.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, you wonder if on some part if we've invited them into our space.
But maybe we called them in. Maybe the human species says, oh, like, here's, I can't actually inhabit this reality with presence. I'll just give it to you and you can just, you know, you can inhabit that space instead so I don't have to.
Well, they might also be triggering us to spiritually progress as well. Do you ever see that narrative?
Well, I think there is that. There is that element in the narrative or any narrative.
There
is like the bad guys. You know, any kind of dramatic element has the bad guys. And if you are talking about the greater game or the greater story or narrative, it's like, how are the bad guys going to be bad guys? They're going to be bad because they're sock puppets. They're being really directed and driven and propelled by the real bad guys.
You
know, they form alliances with the really fought, their hand is forced.
So what in your intuitive sense, what do you see like happening? If you want to chuck your hat in
my hat into the ring. Well, I think it could well be, and I don't know exactly, but I think a lot of people at this point are very concerned about the issues that we're seeing that involve the censorship. You know, there's so much focus that people have. People's lives are so driven by social media.
You know,
which are owned by these companies. And some people say, oh, well, it's just a company and they can decide. But there's really this attempt to control a narrative.
Yeah, definitely.
And that dissent from the narrative is really, it's not allowed. You know, you're really, and you have.
But
you
I
have
feel to, like it's a losing battle because it's such a, the narrative's fractured into so many different sort of permutations now.
Yeah.
That even the people defending the old narrative, it's like they're just yelling that stuff to a smaller, dwindling crowd.
Mm. And then you have this whole cancel culture thing. And I think there was quite an interesting animation that was shown on the Rebel Wisdom.
Oh, the cancer gods. Is that animation finished?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I just saw the little bits.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of another aspect. I think there's like, I think we're seeing this real sort of like, whatever's happening, we're being pushed.
Yeah.
We're being strained. We're being manipulated.
Yeah.
And there's all these different forces that are really, you know, crossing that barrier, crossing that line.
Yeah.
Which we don't normally see. And we're just, and I think there's a word that's quite interesting. Fascism.
Yeah.
And people using this word. When we talk about fascism, we talk about the Nazis who are ostensibly the most evil human beings who have ever lived, you know. But what we're really talking about when we use the word fascism is people who are really trying to tell us what to do, how to think, and forcing our hand in a way. And when Australia is the only country, for example, to say that vaccinations for a vaccine that hasn't been invented yet, that hasn't been tested, is to be mandatory.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people were like, wait a minute, my hand is being forced. In Australia right now, we can't leave Australia. Our freedoms have been impeded by the government. So I think we're seeing perhaps we're seeing the shape of...
The preview.
Yeah, the preview of where things are going. And I think a lot of us would like to think that we kind of go back to normal, as it were. But I think that perhaps this is very much related to us as a species coming to terms and seeing the tyranny. And I think really, and then if we see it and if it shows at hand and it comes out of the shadows, then
it's, I feel like it's kind of pretty out of the shadows.
A lot of people are not, you're just a conspiracy theorist, Nick.
And
I say, you're just a conspiracy theorist, Nick.
Well, yeah, but most of the conspiracies seem to have some aspect of truth or some portion of truth. I think there's some noise in the signal, definitely.
But yeah, I think that we are possibly looking at a kind of, greater control being enforced.
Yeah.
And we're already seeing that in China.
Yeah.
It's already happening. And the technology is increasing at a greater pace. Yeah. And you have all these people who, you have the emergence of AI.
Yeah.
And you have all these people who believe somehow that human beings are redundant.
Yeah.
And only see human beings as some informational processing units.
Yeah.
And that can you want to upload out of consciousness into computers.
Mark Maron has a good line about humans being the only, the future of humanity is being the only part of your home entertainment system that eats and shits.
the other sort of aspect to where humanity is at that's quite interesting is how, especially these psychoactive plants are waking people up. Mm. The more people are waking up, they're getting aligned. They're realizing who they are. They're seeing what the real issues in themselves and humanity is.
Yeah.
So I think that's all happening at the same time. And we're having this real convergence, collision, that appears to be really going somewhere.
Yeah.
And I think that it's going to be interesting to watch.
It's already interesting now.
And we've got to, maybe I just stay here in Darwin, in Humpty Doo, and just brave the 9 months of intolerable heat.
Well, it's not that bad after a while. Got a pool, got a nice spa. Yeah.
But I think, there must be a conclusion to this story. And I have my own ideas about that. And I've written a book. And I go into that.
So you can't tell us, obviously, because I'm not reading the book.
I don't want to spoil the book. But I have my own. And they're only ideas.
Yeah.
And I think it's great to explore ideas and really see what the possibilities are.
Yeah.
And also to see our human potential.
Yeah.
And embrace that and see how could we live?
Yeah.
How could we live and how can we live? And really align with that kind of optimism.
Mm.
Because being negative about the world isn't going to get us anywhere.
Yeah.
Being pessimistic and really probably doing our best the best that we can to, yeah, surf these waves.
Yeah.
And all, but also to really inhabit the space where we can envision
alternatives.
The world that we want to live in, but also the reality within ourselves right now that we want to live in, and so, really just work, you know, do the work and be in such a way where you're actually, you know, you're able to be and exist in this world, however it is, and deal with it.
I definitely have thought along those lines, and I know at the beginning of the podcast I talked about this attraction to dystopia. I wouldn't even say it was an attraction. It's just this, because you know, you do all this work and you do meet people who are sort of activating and are on the path, but then you get a large swathes of the population which, without trying to sound condescending, but you know, they're not really tuned into this sort of stuff at all. So how do you see them? Like, where do they fit into the picture?
They don't really fit into the picture. No, they're extras in the
They're
picture.
Extras, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know...
They're great for what they are. I mean, it's like the taxi driver in Darwin who calls the Arabic-looking man a towelhead.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's amusing.
Yeah.
And I can't take it too seriously. It's like, how can I get offended by such ignorance?
Yeah.
There's no point. It can't take him too seriously.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of people take too many people too seriously.
Mm.
And it might be better just to accept people for what they are.
Mm.
And not get offended by them, and just and there's a lot of,
it's not so much offense, but it's like, you know, I feel like there is a push towards some level of change, but then there's great resistance from, I guess, people who are.
Here's the thing, I think a lot of people have the idea that they're trying to wake up the masses, and wake up everyone. I don't necessarily think that is ever going to be a successful endeavor.
No, I've learned that from experience as a facilitator.
Yeah.
It's not a cut and dried.
So you've really just got to work with the people. And I think, say, you're working with these medicines. You're working with the people who can make use of them.
Yeah.
And the people who can't make use of them are not going to show up.
Yeah.
So, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's completely okay. I think it's useful to not have hatred in your heart.
Mm.
To Donald Trump, to what's his name again? Who's the Joe Biden? Dan Andrews, the Premier of Victoria, ScoMo, our Prime Minister. Yeah, the taxi driver calling the Arab a towelhead. I think there's no point like hating anyone.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think that it can be useful to critique people.
Mm.
And
what, like to their face?
To their face.
Did you say anything to them?
Write a letter.
Yeah.
To them.
Dear Mr. Taxi Driver.
But at that time, I did not feel that he would be receptive to any kind of feedback. And I thought it was inappropriate. I was like, no, just enjoy this moment.
Yeah.
And
well, it's a lot of energy.
It's a lot of energy. And to put to expect him to see the world as I do.
Yeah.
He sees the world as he does. And I've just got to, in that instance, I just take on that down as a unique experience as it was.
Yeah.
One that I don't experience very often.
Yeah.
And maybe for some people, they experience that reality quite a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think when you do see or you do perceive that people could be doing better, And I think it can be useful not to maybe critique is the wrong word, but to
bring to their awareness.
Bring their awareness to where they could improve. And I think that's what the plants do.
They do,
but because it's not a human, they go, hey, you're fucked up. Like there's stuff going on with you, and you like your ego goes, resistance. I saw a naturopath recently.
Yeah.
And I never actually had it done, like iridology, and they read like the veins around your eye, actually. So I never had it done. He's actually able to read your body through that. And I think I'm relatively healthy, and I had to take a knock and go, oh, actually he's right about, oh, this is actually a real, that's actually a problem there.
Yeah.
And go, you can't get complacent with your health.
Yeah.
You've got to be very vigilant and admit, oh, okay, well, I might think I do eat healthily, compared to many.
Yeah.
But your body your body doesn't care about what everyone else eats.
And
how you live. It cares about its own health and what's optimal for your body.
Yeah.
You know? So, there was a slight sort of like realization, like, yeah, I need to, up my game.
Yeah.
And I thought my game was pretty good already.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. I can't up my game. So I think there is that, as long as people are willing to acknowledge that they're not perfect.
Yeah.
And that they haven't got it all together, which most people clearly haven't, and that they're willing to make some changes and focus on those things, that if we can support each other in constructive change, that's a great thing. And it may require uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah. Well, actually, Julian, you know what I think of you? Yeah. Well, I guess that's,
I think
that's about it.
I think we might be done. We might be cooked.
Yeah.